This podcast is brought to you by lineupmedia.fm.
You're listening to This Day in History, a podcast dedicated to examining history from a standpoint of determining which event on any given day had the greatest impact on our lives. Now your host, Tony Hubert and Armand Kachigian.
Welcome to This Day in History on lineupmedia.fm. Tony Hubert with you and my partner Armand Kachigian as we bring you This Day in History for November the 24th. And it's brought to you by audible.com and by amazon.com. Armand,
yeah.
Just a few of the things that happened
Let's get right to it.
1429, during the Hundred Years' War, your friend, your ally, Joan of Arc, unsuccessfully besieges
La Charité. I was on the side of the English in that one. By the way, do you know how long the Hundred Years' War actually was?
70 years?
No.
Nope.
116 years.
116.
1337 to 1453.
The 116 Years' War just does not have a ring.
Yeah.
At all.
They've rounded it off.
In 1835,
there's three digits.
Just before Texas became a state, their provincial government authorizes the creation of a horse-mounted police force to be called the Texas Rangers.
Yeah, the Texas Ranger. I mean, and we're not talking about the ball team, of course, but I guess the most famous would probably be the Lone Ranger. Wasn't he a Texas Ranger?
His brother was
killed, right? Yes. And then he took his... Did he make his mask out of his brother's shirt or his... I don't know something about it anyway. Mm-hmm. But how about... The only other one I know that's famous is the guy that... Hamer? Remember him? The one that tracked down Bonnie and Clyde?
Yes.
Yeah, he was a Texas Ranger.
Yes.
He didn't like Bonnie and Clyde.
Not too many people did.
Killed him in Louisiana.
The Texas Rangers still do exist. They're now a... The Texas Ranger Division. It's a division of the Texas Department of Public Safety.
Okay.
All right. In 1863, the American Civil War, the Battle of Lookout Mountain.
Not real familiar with this one.
Okay, this is near Chattanooga, Tennessee, and it's a big one because of the geography of the area. The Union, under the direction of Ulysses S. Grant, captures Lookout Mountain. Now, you know you can see seven different states from Lookout Mountain.
I've never been there, but
it's a beautiful place. Gorgeous place. And they begin to break the Confederate siege of Chattanooga, which was led by General Braxton Bragg.
All right. I'm going to have to look. I'm not a big Civil War guy, I have to say.
Well, if you've heard the name Bragg.
Yes, I have.
Okay.
Braxton Bragg.
1877, Anna Sewell, she, a novelist, publishes Black Beauty.
Never read it. Have you?
I've read it once, but I prefer The Black Stallion.
All right, I've never read it.
In 1917, in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, nine members of the Milwaukee PD, the police department, are killed by a bomb. Now, this is significant because this will be the most deaths in a single event in U.S. police history until September 11th, 2001.
I was just wondering about that. I mean, most police deaths, I guess. I was wondering who said, was that the communists or whatever? I don't know. That was the days of the Palmer raids and Mitchell and all those guys. I was wondering who set that bomb? Do you know?
I do not recall.
Look that up.
It's one of those facts where they say, terrorism has come to America. No, terrorism had been in the United States long before September 11th. And that's one very big example. In 1932, Washington, D.C., the FBI Scientific Crime Detection Laboratory, better known as the FBI Crime Lab, officially opens its doors. That's a big one.
I guess. I didn't think it was that significant.
Really? You don't think the study of forensic evidence is significant?
Sure, but I don't know about the opening of the crime lab. I mean, one of these days, I'm sure when J. Edgar Hoover took over or, the founding of the FBI or when it would change from what it was before. It wasn't, I don't remember what it was called before. Anything. We'll have a story on that, I'm sure, later on.
We definitely will. But, so I think it's a very
significant. I don't know
significant,
about the crime lab opening.
I think it's very significant because the technology employed and developed henceforth has an effect on us to this day.
I would think it was very rudimentary. That crime lab, we probably laugh at it now.
But fingerprint.
But
and
one
other,
of these days, we'll go over DNA evidence, which is, now that's big.
That is,
now that's That's how we catch people.
Fast forward a couple years to 1941 during World War II. The United States, not yet involved, but on this date, because they're going to be involved in about 2 weeks from this date, November 24th, the United States grants Lend-Lease to the French Free Forces.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I didn't know about this one, and I really don't know what we lent and leased to the Free French Forces. I mean, De Gaulle was in London. I don't know what the hell. They weren't really fighting anybody. So I would like to look up that one too. Although I'm totally opposed to Lend-Lease. I mean, in my opinion, Lend-Lease was Roosevelt is not one of my favorite people. I can't wait for his birthday to excoriate him. But you know, that's basically, if you think about it, Lend-Lease to the British was basically a declaration of war de facto, in my opinion. How can you give 50 destroyers to a side that's fighting another side? And I'm not saying you're at war with them. I don't know. I mean,
Well, they did it, and they did, and yeah. Eventually they were at war with them, which is eventually, where everyone knew this was going.
Yeah, but that's what Roosevelt wanted to do. But believe me, I've read a lot about that one.
Into the mind of FDR.
Well, yes, I have. I have insight in the mind of FDR because I've read books by people that were very close to him.
Have
that
you
he
read
just itching to get a war with Germany?
Have you read one of the latest books?
Okay.
H.W. Brands. Wrote a book called Traitor to His Class.
Yeah,
you know, a biography.
I've seen it, but I will read that.
And
one.
I highly recommend that you pick
that
up.
I'm going to put it on my Kindle or get on Amazon.
You get on Amazon or look for the audio version at audible.com.
Right. Yeah, I may listen to it in my car. That's
now,
a good one. Good.
Also, on this date right. in 1963, I want to expound upon this for just a second.
All right, good.
The murder of Lee Harvey Oswald, the presumed assassin of President John F. Kennedy. The murder takes place 2 days after the assassination on a Sunday morning, unequivocally by Jack Ruby. That's not in debate.
I don't think so.
And it happens in the basement of the Dallas Police Department headquarters.
On national TV.
This happens on national TV.
Yes.
This is big for two reasons, in my opinion. One, there's no subsequent trial of Lee Harvey Oswald and no further investigation of facts that may have been uncovered.
How long did he live after? Because he had terminal cancer. I know, but he lived a while, didn't he?
Jack Ruby passed away in, I believe, 1967.
Wow, he lived that long. Wow, okay.
Yeah, and he tried repeatedly to get to Washington so he could tell his side of the story. However, there are two things that happened. One, this is where the conspiracy theorists and theories around the assassination really take root. Because the would-be presumed assassin is assassinated himself.
Right.
Two, I've heard a comic say this, and I cannot remember the comic's name for the life of me, and I looked at this. But if you ever want to know why America is so infatuated with television, if you're sitting at home on that Sunday morning, November the 24th in 1963, and you're watching television, and the man who is the presumed assassin of the President of the United States is walked out and assassinated himself on live TV, you're never turning off the TV again.
Well, I don't know. Maybe not for live events, but I don't know. I think what really made TV as popular as it is Friday Night Boxing. And that's that's what most people say.
Arma,
or the wrestling.
Have to admit.
And the wrestling. I don't know if it was this one
you
act.
You have to admit. The most incredible. And you're
but
not.
It is.
You're, I know if I was a kid at that age, I'd be like, I'm never. No, this stays on all the time now.
Okay.
Just stays on all the time.
I'm against that, and I'm against Lend-Lease.
And also the fact that the Jack Ruby, this, and I'll be real quick about this, all the conspiracies concerning Jack Ruby and this planned hit that was ordered by the mob on Lee Harvey Oswald have been completely debunked multiple times. He had no intention of being there. A set of circumstances. Are you familiar with this?
No, not really.
Okay. Oswald on that Sunday morning is due to be moved, transferred at around 10
that
o'clock.
I know. Right.
The transfer gets backed up because they're still upstairs with Oswald and they're trying.
They're interrogating him.
Well, he's in the, you know, they're trying. And at this point, at 10 o'clock, Jack Ruby's still at home. He gets a phone call from one of his workers, a dancer at the Carousel Club.
Right, that's
saying,
his place, right?
I need your help. You need to get me some money. And
all right.
Okay, she needed some cash. And he said, okay, I'll help you out. He gets in his car, takes his dog with him. He had a dog that he took everywhere.
I'd like to know the name of that dog.
It's a little dog.
That's a good trivia question.
Goes downtown and gets in line at Western Union for a money order. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
By the time he gets there, it's, you know, almost 11 something. He actually has a time stamped receipt of the transaction in his pocket when he is arrested, Ruby. He proceeds to walk back up to the street to his car. Now, the timing of the delay of Oswald, Ruby having to go and get this money order for a worker, and the fact that the vehicle that they're going to transport Oswald in will not be able to back fully down the ramp into the basement leaves the door, the sliding garage door, open.
To the police station?
Yes, allowing him to head down the ramp as he passes by. He simply gets in the crowd with everyone else, and moments later, Oswald is brought out.
So what occasioned him to kill him, though?
An
impulse?
Ruby testified it was an impulse, and because of a smirk that he saw on Oswald's face.
Well, I know how that feels.
And
I don't like the smirking.
At that point, he just flipped.
It's one thing
reached
to assassinate
someone. Reached into his pocket,
someone.
Took out the gun, stepped forward, and shot him.
Yeah, I can forgive him for assassinating Kennedy, but smirking,
assassinating Oswald.
No, I'm talking about Oswald.
Oh,
now
so
I
you
can see
forgive
why
that.
Yeah, I can see why Ruby would be pissed and want to blow his brains out.
Two other ones.
Interesting. I didn't know that. I thought it was...
And there is plenty of documentation on this one, widely debunked. The set of circumstances that occurred
to
put Ruby and Oswald in the same place at the same time.
It was the mob
it's incalculable.
Okay.
It's incalculable. And if it was indeed a mob hit, the cover story that they somehow arranged to make this happen, almost impossible as well. You just can't.
I was never one to believe the mob hit on any of this stuff, but.
So in 1971, November 24th,
this
is a good one.
It's a classic.
And this one you can go either way on. During a severe thunderstorm over Washington State, a hijacker calling himself Dan Cooper, a.k.a. D.B. Cooper, parachutes from a Northwest Orient Airlines plane with $20,000 in ransom.
No, $200,000.
$200,000 in ransom money, and he has never been found. There are myriads of documentaries that you can watch on History Channel.
They also made a feature about it, too. I didn't see it.
On other channels.
D.B. Cooper.
About D.B. Cooper, about subsequent money that was found years later, I believe 9 to 10 years later, and about the family of D.B. Cooper.
I have to look into
that. It's very well worth the watch.
All right.
And finally, in 1996, Barry Sanders, Detroit Lions.
Yeah.
His eighth consecutive 1,000-yard season. How about that?
He's only surpassed by Peyton and Smith. But what I like about Barry Sanders, a couple of things. He's my, you know, I added this because he's my favorite running back and probably the greatest, definitely the greatest running back of all time, in my opinion. He still holds the record for the most collegiate yards. I think it was 2,800 yards at Oklahoma State.
All-purpose?
I guess. I'm not sure. It had to be. I guess he couldn't rush for 2,800. Maybe. I don't know. I got to look that up. But he's very close to breaking Peyton's record. And then he just retired.
He retired.
Shocked everybody by retiring. But what I liked about him, he's a very humble guy, it seems like. You know, you never saw him spiking the ball or never had this dance or whatever, just always handed it to referee. And
when you're as good as Barry, you don't need any of that.
And he was about my height, and I admire
you appreciated
him.
The smaller
boy,
guy.
Boy, I'll tell you, 5'8", 205 pounds, but he was 205 pounds, which is pretty heavy for a running back, all in his legs.
All right, here are the big topics on store for us today, right? We have five of them circled today on our list. The first one will go to 1859, the publication of On the Origin of Species. And boy, if you want to throw some people for a loop on a trivia question, ask them to name that book.
Origin of Species.
You'll get Origin of Species as the answer every time, and that is not the name. On the Origin of Species is the name, published Charles Darwin, your author.
Why not my author? I don't think, first of all, it's kind of a mistake to think that he came up with all these himself. A lot of these theories, in fact, even his own grandfather had postulated a lot of these evolution theories.
No, he stood on the shoulder of others here.
Yeah, Erasmus Darwin. And I think the main thing I would say about this, or the thing that I think most people mistake about the actual theory of evolution, is that, you know, that somehow that there's some sort of point to it, or there's something, you know, that, well, it's commonly called survival of the fittest,
mm-hmm.
which is something I don't think he didn't coin that term. I think it was Spencer coined that term, Herbert Spencer. And that's not true either. It's basically it's survival of he who reproduces is what the, and that just goes to show, like, if you're very strong, whatever, a finch, for instance, which is what Darwin, and or goldfish or whatever, and you fight another goldfish for to reproduce,
you fight territoriality, for mating purposes. Yeah,
to mate, and you two wear each other out, or, you know, incapacitate each other, and while I'm a weaker goldfish and I'm the one that gets to mate, my genes are passed on, and hence I am successful.
Well, you need to restate that. You're not the weaker goldfish.
Well, if the weaker goldfish is the one that mates, while the two stronger fight to the death or whatever, it's whoever reproduces. And
yes.
It's basically, I remember in college, my genetics teacher, if you have a deck of cards and you deal out five of cards or whatever, and you keep dealing out the same cards, those cards keep reproducing,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's in the gene pool. So success is not necessarily measured by any of these survival of the fittest. It's just whoever passes their genes on.
One of the things about you know, on the origin of species is natural selection versus, you know, and versus random selection. And the best way it was ever put to me is, imagine that a herd of very unique, you know, genetic mountain goats are, you know, walking along a mountain path. And they're the only ones that have this genetic code. You know, and perhaps their coloration is different, and that gives them a slight, you know, attribute advantage. And a landslide, an avalanche occurs and wipes them out. Well, that's random selection.
Yeah.
Natural selection is, you know, a trait that basically you can hunt better, you can eat better, you can protect better, you can breed.
Well, that's what I say. I think that's kind of a misnomer, because it's not necessarily the best traits that are passed on. For whatever reason.
No, it's not, because now you're going
adaptable,
in, you're going into the genetic world, but the adaptions that are the adaptations that are beneficial often get to
tend
reproduce.
To these mutations, it's usually through mutation, in fact always, because it's all genetic, you know, all genetic variation is through mutation. And most mutations, of course, are deleterious, and they immediately, you know, stamp themselves out, because, mm-hmm. you know, most mutations are so bad, the creature doesn't even survive. But there are some, quote, good ones.
A desired mutation.
I.e. mutations that enhance the creature's ability to reproduce. You know, there's also, you know, like, I don't know if you ever heard of Lamarckianism.
Lamarck, no.
He was a Frenchman, and as usual, being a Frenchman, he was wrong. He looked at like a giraffe, you know, for instance, and he said, the giraffe's got this long neck because he needs to get up in the trees and eat whatever giraffes eat from these branches.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the giraffe developed this long neck. And the giraffes theoretically would get longer and longer necks, because they would get easier. It'd be easier to get the fruit, the higher hanging fruit, which is total nonsense, has nothing to do with it. And Darwin kind of proved that.
Right.
That these adaptations are not, there is no design. That's what Lamarckianism is. And it was big for a while. In fact, I wrote a paper in college on it.
But it's hard for people, I think, to understand it's not the design, it's the result that is perpetrating.
Well, you said it yourself, there is random mutation also, and there's random selection,
but
natural selection is just, that's what it is. Right. You know, when I always laugh when somebody says,
because the notion that you're kind of taught, and you're, I think, I especially think American children are taught this wrong.
A lot of biologists are taught this.
You're sort of taught, well, they needed to develop a longer neck, so they did.
Yeah.
Well, no.
That's Lamarckianism.
The giraffe didn't go, oh, I really need a longer neck.
Right. Nature doesn't do that.
The female giraffes did not go looking for long-necked mates. That did not happen.
And conversely, I remember when I was in, I guess I was in high school, maybe college. I think it's high school, my biology teacher, I'll never forget, that said, within, 10,000 years or 20,000 years, human beings will have no pinkies, because it serves no purpose. And I believed that until I started, you know, actually went to college and learned something.
No,
it has nothing to do with it.
Still in your code.
Yeah, it has nothing to do with that.
For instance, that is immediately discounted for this. Humans still have an appendix.
Sure, earlobes, appendix. We have all these vestigial organs that really have no theoretical purpose.
Right. They're not going away.
It doesn't matter.
They're still part of the genetic code.
Right, that's not the way evolution works.
And so to get an understanding of that, I mean, Darwin, you know, certainly moved the ball forward.
Yeah.
A lot.
Darwin was more, I mean, he was more of an observer. He went on the Beagle with Fitzroy.
What a great name for a boat.
Yeah, the Beagle. Crazy. But anyway, took a long 7-year trip. And an interesting thing about that was, you know, his father didn't want him to go. You know who funded that trip and gave him the money?
I always thought it would have been like the Royal Geographic, but who?
Josiah Wedgwood, the pottery guy. Famed for his Wedgwood pottery.
Well, yeah. I love his pottery.
Yeah, friends. Well, that I don't think we would have had Darwin go on that trip if he hadn't convinced his father. And even that didn't convince him. He said, well, I'll pay for it. And he said, okay, go ahead. Because the father didn't want him to go.
All right, let's move ahead to the next one that you have circled, Armand.
Yeah.
1922. This was interesting. I thought that you circled that. So I wanted to get your entire take on this. 9 Irish Republican Army members, 9 IRA members are executed by an Irish Free State firing squad. Among them is the author, Robert Erskine Childers, who had been arrested for illegally carrying a revolver. That happened November 24th, 1922.
Well, yeah, I didn't circle because of that, because this incident I'm not familiar with, although it's certainly in keeping with what was going on at that time. I would just want to comment on, you know, the English that were there, the Royal Irish Constabulary, mm-hmm. the Black and Tans, mm-hmm. and how they are still notorious. If you want to talk about it, I wouldn't walk into an Irish bar anywhere. In fact, I wouldn't even say it in front of our friend John, who has, doesn't he have the Irish show?
Yes.
Yeah, or whatever it's
Celtic
called.
Music Lab.
Right. I wouldn't go up to John and even say Black and Tan unless I was ready for fisticuffs, or I guess Irish would be a Donnybrook.
Mm-hmm.
Because they are so hated to this day, and what they did, you know, they were terrorizing. Because basically they had the Irish Free State, and Irish were granted home rule in 1914, I believe. Well, then World War I came, and the British said, well, let's hold off on home rule for a while. And then you had the Easter Uprising in 1916. I forget the Irish Casement, Roger Casement. He was actually in cahoots with the Germans and he was executed, by the way. Interesting character to look up. But anyway, after the war, they were losing pretty badly. They had the Royal Irish Constabulary, who were more or less police, and they just couldn't handle it because the Irish were just up in arms. They're Protestants, and they were terrorizing these guys. So they brought in the Black and Tans, who were basically World War I veterans who got a taste of killing and liked it and didn't really have much to do. So they sent them to Ireland, and these guys ran amok. And that's why they're much hated. One of my favorite movies is called The Informer.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about Mutiny on the Bounty the other day. The Informer, Victor McLaughlin won the Academy Award for this. He is by the way, the only Academy Award winner to also fight for the heavyweight boxing championship of the world.
Now there's a piece of trivia.
Yeah, and he lost. But that was about, you know, the Black and Tans and the situation. It's a great movie.
All right.
That
takes us up to the part of the show we like to go to some birthdays, and we'll do that
in a second.
But let me tell you, one of our fine sponsors, Audible.com, a better marriage has never happened in podcasting. Then audible.com and this day in history. It's perfect.
It's a symbiotic relationship.
There you have it. You go to audible.com, and what we encourage you to do is go to audibletrial.com, because a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial is waiting there for you. It's all at audibletrial.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, your Android, your Kindle, or your MP3 player.
See, now that's almost a providential symbiosis. I think that now that's almost Lamarckian. Maybe the guy had something to that.
Oh, so a French guy did something after all.
Well, he was wrong. That's right. I forgot his nationality.
Keep in mind how my last name
now,
is.
That's not racism, by the way.
Is properly pronounced.
Because I'm not, I don't hate the man because of his race. I hate him because of his ethnicity.
Oh, okay.
French.
Okay. Ethnicity, his
nationality.
Right.
Yeah. Not even his ethnicity, his nationality.
Xenophobic.
Just the French.
Okay. Yeah. 1784, the birth of Zachary Taylor, American general, a politician, of course, the 12th president of the United States. He would die in 1850.
And this is a trivia question that I'll bet you, you go to enough of these contests, you'll get it. He was related to another president. In fact, he was the father-in-law of a president. Want to take a guess?
Andrew Johnson.
Nope. Good guess, though. That would be the only reason. Actually, he was the father-in-law of Jefferson Davis. I didn't say he was the president of the United States, mind you.
Oh, you trickster.
Yes, it is. Yes. Isn't that horrible?
That is horrible.
Jefferson Davis, president of the Confederacy.
1859, gentleman by the name of...
It's his birthday, but I'd like to expound on his death. Because remember, they disinterred him because they thought he might have been poisoned. Apparently, you know, he ate a bunch of... It was a hot day, and he ate a bunch of strawberries and cream, as... Mm-hmm. People did that, apparently, and it wasn't...
Thought he was at Wimbledon before Wimbledon?
Right, the good old days of Wimbledon, right? And that was kind of his favorite dish or one of them, and I guess they hadn't been prepared. I don't know how you prepare them, but anyway, probably been sitting out.
I'm going to say the cream went bad.
Yeah, and he was poisoned and died not too long afterwards, despite or probably because of medical treatment he got. You know, they gave him the old bleeding and all that stuff, Ipecac, all these great things that they do to people. But anyway, he died. They disinterred him, and I don't know. They still haven't figured out whether he was poisoned or not. They thought it might be arsenic. So anyway, that's interesting about Zachary Taylor.
Also, November 24th, Cass Gilbert. I bring this name up. He's an American architect.
Mm-hmm. Sure is.
Architect, and he designed the United States Supreme Court building and the Woolworth building.
Right, one of my favorite buildings.
So some of the real influential architecture that we see in the United States.
I think he also designed the first Madison Square Garden, didn't he?
I will have to check.
The first one. I mean, it's like the fourth one that we have now.
We're on MSG4, technically.
Yeah. I think he did the first one.
This is a guy I think you would have liked to hang out with, even though he was French. 1864, Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec.
I would like to hang out with him because he's shorter than I am.
Okay.
He's only 4'11".
I think he knew how to party, though.
He was great. Yeah, he loved. He did pretty good for a guy that was 4'11", ugly guy. Had both his legs were broke. I think he had, I'm trying to think of I'm not sure what disease he had, but multiple fractures of his legs. That's why he had a bone development disease, and that's why his legs, you know, his femurs kept breaking. And that's why he was, you know, 4'11", 4'10", and, you know, more or less crippled. But, boy, the prostitutes loved him, and he liked to paint them. And that's nice, you know, instead of, hey, come up and see my etchings, you know, come on up and I'll etch you. And Toulouse did all right.
He did okay for himself.
The demi-monde of Paris.
1867, Scott Joplin was born on this date. Another guy you probably would have liked to hang out with.
St. Louis guy.
Died
of syphilis.
St. Louis. Is that why you wanted to hang out with him?
Well, yeah, well, I aspire to do that myself. unfortunately for Scott Joplin, I mean, that Maple Leaf rag. Now, I'm not sure if this is true, but they claim that was the first million dollar grossing sheet music. I think it is, but I've read conflicting.
I hope he got a piece of the publishing then.
Yeah, he did okay. His problem was he wanted to be an opera composer, and he composed Tremonisha, his only opera, and it was a big flop. That pretty much really put him, you know, kind of in the doldrums, and his syphilis was kind of driving him mad.
Well, that tends to do that.
As it used to do.
Yeah.
And, so he died.
So on this date, November 24th, here's one for you, Armand.
My favorite, yeah.
The Italian-American mob boss, perhaps the godfather of them all.
Yeah.
Lucky Luciano was born in 1897.
Yeah, you know, and it's kind of, I don't know if you're a Capone guy or a Luciano guy. You got to be one or the other. It's like, you know, it's kind of like Marianne and Ginger. Who's your favorite gangster? Because I think Luciano.
Luciano, to me, is the better gangster. Capone is just blunt force trauma.
Yeah, Luciano was, and you know, but although, you know, when you think about it, Capone went to jail for tax evasion. Luciano went
But he had been in jail prior to that.
Yeah, but petty stuff.
Right.
But the big one that put it, the one that put Luciano away was prostitution. They actually got him for soliciting. I don't know how they did that, trumped up charge. But what I liked about him was that, you know, during World War II, they needed him. So they let him go back to, they deported him, but he was instrumental in, first of all, no more strikes on the dock workers, if, you know, he had all the dock workers in his pocket. And they were also worried about sabotage because the Normandy sunk.
Yes. SS Normandy, big.
Sunk in New York Harbor.
Big boat.
And they suspect that one of the Anselmis, one of his buddies, actually blew it up just so he could get, you know, just so they could say, well, we need Lucky to, you know, mm-hmm. to
scout. Come in and police this.
Exactly, to police the docks. So he was an interesting guy, Lucky Lucci. You know why they called him Lucky, by the way? Now there's conflicting. He's the only man, apparently, to survive being taken for a ride.
Really?
Yeah, three guys threw him in the car, took him for a ride, stabbed him repeatedly with ice picks, and cut his eye. And he's always had that droopy
yeah.
eye.
Yeah.
And threw him out, thought he was dead. He lived.
A piece of history that I'd love to explore more is he went back to Sicily.
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Helped out during the war. Uh-huh.
Just how close the United States perhaps was for Sicilian statehood.
Yeah, that was kicked around a little bit, during the invasion, I guess, or whatever. They needed assistance, obviously. But then again, you know, what the French are to wisdom, the Italians are to aggression. And, the Italians kind of gave up real quick, so I don't know if we need it. But there's probably some books on audio, or at least one on audio.com about that.
It's definitely worth, you know, now, the practicality of that, I cannot imagine it.
Yeah.
But perhaps being a territory of, I think you can imagine
bad
that.
Bad idea. Yeah. You know, and I kind of, Bugsy Siegel was going to put out a contract on Mussolini. He was going to kill him mm-hmm. for us. That would have been interesting to let him do that.
It's not bad outsourcing. I mean, as outsourcing goes.
If you need a job like that done, you go to the mob.
1911, Joe Medwick, American ball player, is born. Joe Medwick is the last person in the National League.
Triple Crown?
To get the Triple Crown.
Right. Interesting thing about Joe, the 1934 World Series, Cardinals
against
Detroit.
This is great. And he is a young man at the time.
Yeah. He was a gas house gang.
He's only like 22 years old.
Oh, was he that young? I don't remember him.
But
okay.
I believe the story you're going to go with is in Game 7 and it's a blowout. St. Louis is beating
like
9-0 Detroit.
To nothing, or something.
And the fans at Tiger Stadium, and I don't think it's even called Tiger Stadium at that point.
I think it was Griffith Stadium.
That's D.C.
Is it? Okay.
Yeah. That's D.C.
Maybe it was Tiger Stadium. Okay.
That park had a couple different names before I think it finally
settled. Briggs? Was it Briggs Stadium?
Briggs Stadium could have been. Same venue.
That's
though.
Where I think that's where Raging Bull fought.
A lot of big
Marcel
boxing
Serdan?
Matches fought at that stadium.
Yeah.
Same real estate, same venue.
Yeah.
Okay. Kennesaw Mountain Land just pulls them out of the game. This is where you're going, right?
Yeah.
Because the fans are basically going to attack.
Yeah, they were throwing garbage at him and all these bottles and everything, and they couldn't even have the game. Because apparently he was the gas house gang, so they played hard.
And he cleated.
Yeah, he came in real hard. I think he went after Gehringer.
Third base.
Gehringer at second or third, right, or whatever. Slid mm-hmm. real hard with his spikes up. The way it's done. It should be done. Go for their heads. Try to poke their eyes out. That's good old-fashioned baseball.
Also,
hardball.
Here's one I just want a brief opinion. William F. Buckley Jr. born on this date in 1925.
I'm ambivalent about William F. But I tell you what, you want to do yourself a favor. Watch him and Gore Vidal on YouTube.
Well, these you can find it. You can find it on Netflix.
It's on Netflix too.
Yes,
okay.
The documentary on those two.
Oh, okay. I've watched those. Those are great.
Very, very
William
good.
William F. Buckley.
1938.
Brilliant guy, though. I mean, what a vocabulary that guy had.
Well, this is
rivals my own.
Rivals your own. Okay.
Yes, that's the highest praise I can bestow.
1938. Oscar Robertson is born. Perhaps a guy born just two decades before his time.
Okay.
I don't know much about him. The original Michael Jordan. Superb player.
Big O.
Yes.
Is he still alive?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
Yes,
good
he
for
is.
Him.
1941, Pete Best, an English drummer and songwriter.
Now, is it true that they kicked him out because he was too popular? I mean, he got more adulation than the rest of the band? Or is that just a myth?
I don't know what's exactly true. I've heard that his looks were a problem.
He was good looking, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've also heard that they simply did not like his drumming, and they knew they could get better. And Lennon was not very kind to him. And if you ever get the chance, there is a documentary called Best of the Beatles.
Mm.
And, you know, it's a trickly, you know, it's
yeah,
a,
yeah.
It's
named, double entendre
it's a,
there. Yeah.
It's a double on. And I got to tell you, he says he says what he says. His statements are a matter of public record. But my goodness to...
Well, is he the fifth Beatle or Stu Sutcliffe the fifth Beatle? I don't know. Or is it Epstein? I don't know. Who's the fifth Beatle? That's
there's a couple different ways to look at it. First of all, he would not be a fifth.
Yeah.
Because if you go with the original lineup that debuts in Liverpool, it depends where you start.
Were they called the Beatles then?
Well, do you start with the Quarrymen performing?
I think that's who you start with.
And if that's the case, a lot different. If you start with the Beatles and in the Hamburg venues, then he's one of the original five.
Okay.
Because you have to have Sutcliffe in there. Star would be sixth Beatle in my estimation. Jimmy Nickel would be seventh. Billy Sheridan would be eighth.
Okay. If you say so. I'm not the biggest Beatles fan. I'm a Led Zeppelin fan.
That's my take. There's been a lot of people who can lay claim to being in the group.
Oh, I guess. I don't know. I don't think that Ringo Starr is as talentless. I mean, I've never seen him rated as a very good drummer.
No, he was the right guy for them.
I guess.
And Brian Epstein was never a member of the band. He was management.
Right, but I've heard him referred to as the fifth Beatle, too. Well, who was Stu Sutcliffe? What did he have to do with them?
He was the original member. And
he actually played something?
He did. He played on stage in Hamburg with them and bowed out him.
He left, too. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Three others to get to real quick. Marlon Fitzwater, I just bring him up because he was a fun press secretary.
Okay.
His glasses were never on straight when he was on TV.
Is he Reagan's?
Yeah. And he
okay.
He always look him up he always YouTube. Looked appropriately disheveled as he addressed the press.
As a press secretary should.
1946, Ted Bundy is born.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
There are tons of books and documentaries, including the incredible line that the judge says to Ted Bundy at the end of his trial.
Is he pure evil or something?
You would have been quite an attorney.
And oh, yeah,
he gave he actually gave Ted a compliment because Ted defended himself.
Right.
And
that was apparently his allure. He was a good-looking guy. He was charming. Yeah. And, boy, he just, man.
And also, a younger guy. You may not know him because you prefer to stay pre-World War II for some reason.
Absolutely.
But Stephen Merchant, the writing partner and actor, you can see him a lot with Ricky Gervais. But Stephen Merchant has really made a name for himself in the past 10 years.
Okay.
All right, there's our birthdays. Back to some of the bigger topics. One of the ones you had circled in 1944 on November 24th, the 73rd Bombardment Wing becomes the first U.S. force to attack Tokyo from the Northern Marianas Islands. Not the first U.S. force to reach Tokyo because that is Doolittle's raid.
Right, the Doolittle raid, 42.
But from the Northern Mariana Islands in 44, this sets up the eventual firebombing of Japan.
That's what I wanted to discuss. Well, I mean, I actually really want to discuss Curtis LeMay.
Well, we can talk about Curtis LeMay, but this is his program. Do you know who else was involved in the architecture of this type of program that they ran from the Northern Marianas Islands? This is a name that you might be surprised to hear.
No, I don't think
this is Robert McNamara.
Oh, was he in there? Yeah, I know McNamara was very close to LeMay.
And this is the use of statistics as a war mechanism.
Sounds like Robert.
And to know what to hit and what to weaken to eventually weaken your enemy.
So I guess what you're implying is that this evolved into our strategy in Vietnam, because that's what McNamara,
involve into a U.S. strategy. My grandfather was a CB. You know, remember CBs?
Construction battalion.
He worked at Saipan and Tinian. And
was he there when they brought the bomb and everything?
Yes.
The Indianapolis came in.
Yes.
Wow. Yeah, that was LeMay. Remember Dr. Strangelove?
Well, that is who George Peppard. No.
George C. Scott.
That's who George C. Scott is essentially. Now he is acting that role in 1964 in the Kubrick film when LeMay is still an Air Force general at the time.
Yeah, but LeMay, and he ran for vice president on George Wallace's ticket.
In 68.
Yeah.
Okay, so LeMay, he's been attributed to saying at the conclusion of hostilities in World War II, should have just kept going.
Yeah, and then he's also in Vietnam. He also said we'll bomb them into the Stone Age, although he denies that. He said we could, but that's the quote from what I've heard. Mm-hmm. He said we will bomb them into the Stone Age.
So, after the war, his advocacy was, you're number one right now. Keep going.
Well, you know, he was in Europe before this.
And he wanted to take out Russia.
Well, he also wanted, you know, before he started taking over a squadron, mm-hmm. I don't remember which, the 20th Air Force in Japan, I'm not sure which one it was, but, you know, these planes would take off from their fields in England to go to Schweinfurt, et cetera. In fact, I think he led the Schweinfurt raid, which was a very costly one. The guy was fearless.
Well, he was fearless, and it also shifted the pattern of night bombing.
He wanted precision daylight.
And he went to precision daylight. And the results, while horrific on, you know, Allied forces in terms of loss, but the results that they were getting in terms of destruction on the ground in Germany in precision Allied day were dramatic.
Well, the effectiveness of those have been debated, whether we actually did it. But that's another story. But the thing about him was, you know, early on, these guys – like something would go wrong, any glitch whatsoever in their plane, they'd turn around, these B-17s.
Yeah.
And he said, listen, anybody that doesn't go in his wing, anybody that doesn't go over the target gets court-martialed. And immediately, I mean, and he was right there. He was always, I'm going to be the point man, but anybody that turns back is court-martialed. And that was the end of that stuff. He also, and this is interesting, they firebombed Tokyo and firebomb the Japanese cities for a couple of reasons. But the main thing was, you know, the jet stream worked against them. They couldn't use the same tactics they had in Germany. The wind was always against them. So the daylight bombing wasn't as precision. The precision wasn't there.
They didn't need to be because of the nature of Japanese structural society.
Yeah, and the Japanese war machine was different.
All you had to do was get the napalm close, well, that's what was going to burn.
Well, yeah, because all wooden paper mache is all this stuff. But before that, the Japanese didn't have these big industrial complexes like the Germans did. They were more out in the suburbs, et cetera, and they were all spread out.
Well, you certainly didn't have a rural valley.
Yeah, you didn't have Schweinfurt or the Ploesti oil fields and all this stuff to hit. These targets that were just tailor-made for the bombing raids.
So
he just used incendiary bombs.
The incendiary device, and there's a documentary to watch on this, and it is horrifying to watch, but it's called The Fog of War.
Hmm.
And it is an Errol Morris film. It is it's Robert McNamara sitting down and running through his entire life history. And the section on what they accomplished in World War II through the statistical use of incendiary bombing and the equivalent cities that they were wiping out. You know, they'll show you a Japanese city and they'll show you the American equivalent that's just destroyed. And the lives lost to that manner of bombing make the two nuclear bombs pale.
Oh, yeah. I think 200,000 died in Tokyo.
In comparison, the Tokyo firestorm.
Yeah. That was in March, I think, of 45.
So it's a fascinating documentary. Yeah. I highly recommend. Check it out or find it, Amazon.com. It is a film that you will want to see, and it is a piece of history that's amazing. Absolutely amazing. All right, moving on. 1969, Apollo 12.
Yeah.
How would you like to be the second crew? I mean, I always felt sorry for Buzz Aldrin, but how about the second crew?
Yeah, I think Pete Conrad said something that might have been a small step for Armstrong, Neil, but it was a hell of a long one for me or something like that. That was his line. The only thing I wanted to mention about this is interesting. When Conrad and Bean were on the moon, they retrieved a camera which had been sent up on Surveyor 3.
Okay.
They brought it back to the Earth, and they actually found streptococcus mitis on the camera, which apparently had not been properly antiseptically, you know, had not been sterilized, because all this stuff was supposed to be totally clean. I don't know why they didn't want to send to space, but the idea is that these organisms survived for like 2.5 to 3 years on the moon
in a completely radiated sterile environment.
Atmosphere, yeah. Well, the moon, you know, it's pretty barren. So all I'm trying to say is it kind of bodes well for life outside the Earth.
Can you name the whole crew? Because this again,
I don't remember who but it was Alan Bean and Pete Conrad.
Pete Conrad Jr.
I don't know who was the
Richard F. Gordon.
Gordon, okay, yeah.
Because the Apollo, you know, these guys, they're incredible heroes.
Yeah,
to most Americans, you know Neil Armstrong and you know Buzz Aldrin.
Right.
It's hard to even remember Michael Collins being the
right in the,
being
the lamb, yeah.
In the lamb, yeah, and being the orbiter.
Do you know the last man on the moon?
No. See, I don't, and that's not a good reflection on me.
Well, you'll never forget now. Eugene Cernan.
Cernan.
Yep. Last man on the moon. Hopefully not the last man.
And I believe there's the audio of during that mission, Cernan and the others learning that the space shuttle program had gotten funding, and that's relayed to them when they are on the moon in the
and they find out. Well, you know, Harry, I'm a little disappointed with NASA. I mean, I think we've talked about it. At least I talked with Ocho about it.
Oh, I'm severely disappointed with NASA because as a child of the 70s, I was told I would be vacationing on the moon and going to Mars.
Of course.
My life is over, and I've yet to set foot off this rock, and I doubt that I ever will.
I don't know.
I'm bitterly, bitterly, bitterly disappointed
about it. If it happens, I think it's going to be private. It's not going to be NASA. It's going to be guys like Elon Musk and these visionaries. And if there's profit in it, it will happen. And that's what's going to happen because people are going to pay. They're going to, you know, they're already having these suborbital flights for, I don't know, how many thousand dollars. Once they make those more or less affordable, people are going to be going up there.
Absolutely.
So I don't know if we'll ever see Mars.
I'm willing to risk it. I really am. There's no, look, the human just willingness or just craving desire to journey and to explore.
Well, it's exemplified by these 200,000 volunteers they have to go to Mars.
There you go.
That's a one-way trip.
That's a one-way
trip. Good luck.
You're never coming back.
Have fun. Yeah. Have fun.
And 200,000 people volunteered.
Yeah, 200,000.
I mean, that does tell you something about.
I don't know what it tells you. It's a little disturbing to me because I imagine most of these people are young. Well, do they have that much angst and that much nihilism? I think what they're motivating is not Star Trek stuff. I think the Earth stinks.
I'd rather
go to Mars.
I do not think that's their motivation at all. I think this is almost as close to purely altruistic motivation as you can find.
Well, I admire their sense of adventure, you know, to be like, you know, basically.
Well,
these...
the sense of human adventure has led us to where we are today.
Yeah. Well, the exploration and the yearning to learn and to sound out a new planet. I get that. But, well, I hope it's not that, you know, the Earth stinks.
No.
Global warming is going to finish us all, and I got to get the hell off this rock.
1974. This will be our last in-depth topic for today. Donald Johansson and Tom Gray discover a 40% complete skeleton, Australopithecus afarensis.
Yeah, Australopithecus afarensis. There was also Africanus. The only thing I want to comment about this, because I took a lot of anthropology in college and just put me to sleep. But was this hominin is what it's called.
Yeah. Well, they nicknamed her Lucy.
Yeah.
For the Beatles song.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lucy in the Sky. But did it use tools? And I think they've decided that it did actually the first tool using creature.
And how did they decide? I mean,
they found evidence apparently where they found these, you know, Lucy or wherever they found these in Africa, these gorges or wherever they found these.
Well, Lucy was found in what's called the Awash Valley in Ethiopia.
Okay.
And they found
what looks like bones or whatever they've used, like tools that they used to carve up creatures they've killed and hunted with. So
and
apparently
that part of Ethiopia is called the Afar Depression.
Okay, it's part of the. I think it's part of the ridge, right?
It is a spot.
Great Rift Valley. That's what it is.
It is a spot that geographically, geologically, you would there can be a hominid sort of settlement there. It works, right? So,
well, that's where they find them. The old Davy Gorge is where Leakey did all his work. So yeah, that's where they find this stuff. But that's interesting that, you know, it's 2.9 to 3.9 million years ago this thing existed. Flattened features, and they don't know if it was a knuckle walker or not. It looks like it's shown.
Is that the proper scientific term?
I think it is, yeah. Well, it was a brachiator, which means it lived in the trees and hung, you know, like the modern primates.
Yes.
So they don't know how to classify this thing, but... Here again, don't take anthropology.
Well, it was kind of interesting that on November 24th, we have Darwin's publication, and then, 115 years later, you have the discovery of this.
Yeah. Although
nice, you know, little bookend.
Although, you know, Darwin never suggested that men came from apes, by the way. That was not his thesis on this.
All right. As we do with every show, we close out with who died on this date in history.
We got a couple of good ones.
We love to leave you on a high note. This day in history, 1572, the Scottish pastor and theologian John Knox passed away. He was born in 1510, passed away 1572.
John Knox was quite a guy. He spent a few years in a French galley. Did you know that?
I did not know
that. Yeah, the French attacked, and they sacked his town in Scotland, and took him on board a galley. And they were, you know, and they made it, apparently they were Catholics, so they made him kiss a picture of the Virgin Mary, and he threw it out, and he threw it into the sea.
Oh,
yeah,
geez.
He was a tough old bird. And he was you want to talk about a misogynist? This guy hated—
I don't really want to talk about a misogynist.
He hated Mary of Guise. He hated Mary Queen. That's the classic thing. Mary Queen of Scots, and he had a real running battle. Couldn't stand each other. And he often drove her to tears, and I don't think he shed a tear when she was executed. John Knox, quite a guy. And boy, I'll tell you, nobody could give a fire and brimstone sermon like Mr. Knox, but because of the Scottish are Presbyterians now,
yes,
because of Knox,
yeah,
Protestant.
That's a significant one. 1957, the death of Diego Rivera, the Mexican painter and sculptor.
I'm not exactly sorry to see him go. Communist, didn't like him. But what's interesting about him is Frida Kahlo. And Frida Kahlo had they had a lot of affairs. They got, you know, they fought. They got divorced. They got remarried.
He seemed to have a whole Ava Gardner Sinatra thing going on.
It was quite a relationship. Tumultuous, turbulent. But the Rockefeller Center. Rockefeller commissioned him to do the mural.
Yes.
And then he wouldn't take Lennon's picture off it. So they whitewashed the whole thing and kicked him out of there. It was called Man at the Crossroads. And, you know, he liked to go to Moscow and hobnob with the communists. Not one of my favorite guys.
1963, we mentioned this earlier. Yeah. Of course, Lee Harvey Oswald.
Bad story.
1982, the death. This becomes significant now. Otherwise, it'd be completely overlooked. But Barack Obama Sr., the Kenyan economist and academic, passes away.
I have nothing to add.
1991, the Zanzibari English singer-songwriter.
Did you know
producer.
He was born in Zanzibar?
I did not.
Is that interesting?
But a lot of English, you know, and whether they live in the homeland or they're expats today, are born abroad.
Well, yeah.
There are so many. And you don't have to look very hard.
What's his real name? It's like Hari? We can look that up real quick.
I'll look that up real quick.
As you're looking up. Yeah, I like Freddie Mercury. I like him too. Too bad. Poor guy died of AIDS. Terrible. But great singer. Great singer.
For
my money, one of the best.
He was born in Stone Town, Tanzania.
Tanzania, right. Mm-hmm.
Tanzania.
Isn't it Tanzania?
Well, it depends. If you're English, it's Tanzania.
All right. I don't buy that.
And then he died in Kensington, London. His full name, Farouk Bosara.
Now, was he born? Now, that's interesting. Was he born on the island? Because the island is Zanzibar. It used to be Tanganyika and Zanzibar, and then they formed. They merged to form Tanzania. So I wonder, since it says Zanzibari, I guess he was born in Zanzibar.
And Stone Town is a part of Zanzibar.
Okay. Yeah. So he wasn't born in Tanzania, technically.
It's a district of Zanzibar.
Okay.
So, you know, but like there's a lot of golfers that, you know, identify as English, but, you know,
South African,
Zimbabwe, Botswana, Kenya colony for older English, a lot of
English.
So if
you had to rate vocalists, Freddie Mercury's right up there with Robert Plant. I think Plant's first and Mercury second.
I would put Mercury ahead of Plant.
Wow. Okay.
I would.
Pretty tough.
I would. Again, ahead
Rob
of their
Daltrey?
Ahead of their time. But the theatrical rock and roll, I think he and David Bowie moved the needle significantly, not just artistically, but I think culturally as well. Do you remember watching Freddie in the 70s or early 80s and thinking, huh, this guy's different?
And I just remember Bohemian Rhapsody.
And then realizing, he is really different. You know, this is a gay man leading one of the world's great rock and roll bands, and nobody cared.
Well, to be quite honest, my introduction to Freddie Mercury and seeing what you were saying, I didn't know what gay meant anyway. I was just a kid.
No, I didn't either, but... You know, I had plenty of friends who would routinely gay bash someone, and then in the next breath, if something came on MTV.
They idolized Freddie Mercury.
Imitating Freddie Mercury.
Well, looking back, I guess when you look at a band called Queen, there are indications that, I still didn't get the
subtlety. Did you ever see their introduction to Live Aid? They had one of the great sets at Live Aid.
Is that on YouTube?
1985. You can find
I'll
it.
Check
yeah,
that out.
It's they and U2 had sort of just off the chart good performances.
And I also love them because they had Night at the Opera and Day at the Races.
Well, which named for the Marx Brothers.
Inspired by
films.
The Marx Brothers movies,
absolutely.
And we know we're big fans of them.
And finally, we wrap up with American ball player Warren Spahn.
Probably the greatest left-hander of all time.
I think you have to say
I think he's still got the most wins, 363 or something. He's way over 300.
There's a great story that Lou Brock tells about he's called up, and Lou Brock, a Hall of Famer himself, Warren Spahn. You know, Warren, part of the reason he's not a bigger name is because of who he played for.
The Braves,
right? He played for the Braves.
Well, they did win the World Series.
They did, but Warren Spahn in a major market.
Yeah, he was not.
New York. If he's a New York Yankee.
Milwaukee Brave, even.
If he's a New York Yankee, you know the story.
Sure.
Okay? But he wasn't. He was a Milwaukee Brave. And they are playing, and I think Brock may have even been on the Cubs at this point, not even made his way to the Cardinals, where he's remembered. And he gets to first base off of Spahn, and the coach says, "You be careful. You be
picked
real
off,
careful.
Pick off move."
And he said, Spahn goes into the stretch, and he's leading off. And the next thing he knows, the first baseman has the ball, and he's being tagged out.
Wow.
Because from the top of the stretch, Spahn just zipped it right to first.
Picked him off.
And as he's running off the field, he can hear his coach saying, "I told you.
Wow.
Be careful with this guy."
This is another, since we've gone over some misapprehensions people have, some misconceptions. Warren Spahn, you know the old saying, Spahn insane, pray for rain.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Braves, the rest of the pitching staff wasn't that bad. I mean, so they had Spahn insane.
They were
weren't bad, the rest of them.
They were a very good ball club.
Yeah, they were a real tough team. They won in 57. I think they lost in 58 against the Yankees.
Yeah.
It got reversed.
And,
but they had Eddie Matthews. They had the Fence Busters.
They also had Joe Adcock.
Adcock, Eddie Matthews, and the big one.
Well, they had
Hank Aaron.
They had Hank.
And you do know who was on the first.
I was just going to ask you.
Okay.
You know that Matthews is your first SI cover.
Yeah, Fence Busters, yeah.
I mean, it's quite a team, and again, they played in a small market.
Yeah.
You know, if they are an East Coast team, it's
sure.
one that's remembered for the ages.
They've been legendary.
And I'll never quite understand. You know, you move to Milwaukee, you play there for about 15 years, and then off to Atlanta they go.
Yeah.
And I've had the misfortune of going to County Stadium once. You know,
in Atlanta, Fulton County.
No, in Milwaukee
I've never been.
Brewers game, and. Yeah, it was not a nice place.
The new one's nice.
Oh, the new ballpark in Milwaukee.
Yeah, I've been there.
Gorgeous.
Yeah, it's really nice.
My family loves it. We've been about five times.
Great ballpark.
It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's a nice place to watch a game.
Yeah. So that'll do it for this edition of This Day in History, November 24th. Don't forget, join us tomorrow, another day, November 25th, will be in the books. You can follow our show at thisdayinhistorypodcast.com and on Facebook, facebook.com/thisdayinhistorypodcast. We have a Twitter account, but how much we're going to tweet from it, well, we'll leave that up to Armand. We'll make him our new Twitter
manager. I've never tweeted in my life.
I'd love for you to tweet. If you would just tweet the random musings that came into your head, we would have a gazillion followers.
I ain't no canary. I don't tweet. I don't tell on nobody.
And you can email us at info@thisdayinhistorypodcast. And that's at info@thisdayinhistorypodcast.com. For Armand Kachigi and I'm Tony Hubert, enjoy your day. We'll talk to you tomorrow here on lineupmedia.fm.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.